Welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for November 30th, Thursday. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger, and here is our first story. On the front page, big headline, Meet Nixon, the 2023 Little Yellow Dog. The Little Yellow Dog auction will be Saturday, December 9. It's written by Dolly Blitz, and the dateline is Sioux City. Earlier this month, Carrie Johnson sat in the middle of a litter of 10 teddy bear Bernie Doodle puppies scouting for the 2023 Little Yellow Dog. A 5.8-pound black and white pup with mahogany eyebrows caught her attention. He was trying to climb on our laps, and then, when we were walking, he was trying to tug on the bottom of our jeans, said Johnson, of Family Pet Hospital, who serves as vice president of the Ancient and Effervescent Order of the Little Yellow Dogs. This puppy is seriously amazing. He picked us. Born to Mom Lucy and Dad Chase, both Bernie Doodles, on October 6, the pooch named Nixon will be up for bid during the Little Yellow Dog Auction. The auction, held by the Ancient and Effervescent Order of the Little Yellow Dogs, raises funds for the Sioux City Journal's Goodfellow Charities. The auction will be held at noon on December 9 in the atrium of the Ho-Chunk Center, 614 4th Street. The nonprofit distributes toys and books to underprivileged children. A Bernie Doodle is a cross between the Bernese Mountain Dog and the Poodle. Bernese Mountain Dogs are very large, playful, and laid back. They are the brains and the brawn of the breed, according to Johnson. She said, Toodles are lively, fun-loving, and alert. You put these two together, and it's like the best of both worlds, she said. These puppies are very special. They love being with the family. They love little children. They're good with the elderly. Nixon was donated by Pat and Karen Kuehl, K-U-E-H-L, and named after the late Dave Nixon Sr., a longtime Sioux City TV news anchor and Little Yellow Dog auction MC. Johnson said this year's Little Yellow Dog is incredibly sweet and will weigh between 20 and 30 pounds when fully grown. Since he will be on the smaller side, she said an apartment or a townhouse could provide an ample dwelling space for him. He's just special in so many ways, Johnson said. This is just the cutest little roly-poly goofy puppy. He just ticks off all the boxes. Nixon will require frequent brushing and need to see a groomer every 6 to 8 weeks. Johnson said Nixon's dad has more of the poodle characteristics, including curlier fur, while his mom's coat is black, white, and tan and relatively thick, more reminiscent of the Bernese Mountain Dog. She said Bernie Doodles can live as long as 14 to 16 years. Johnson said she talked to a number of breeders and was completely impressed with Little Paws of Iowa, where Nixon hails from. She said his parents have been genetically tested and their hips are OFA certified. She said Nixon comes with a one-year guarantee. Before he goes on the auction block at 9 weeks old, Nixon will have been examined by a veterinarian, received his age-appropriate vaccinations, and microchipped. These guys do some serious work to make sure that their breeding is spot on, Johnson assured of Little Paws of Iowa. And so, the breeders being the good breeders that they are, he can't leave his mom, until he's 8 weeks. I won't be able to pick him up until November 30. Well, that would be today. Started by a journal reporter in 1914, Goodfellow Charities is one of Siouxland's oldest charities. Skippy, the first dog auctioned by the Yellow Dog Auction Club, was sold for $25, a sizable amount back in 1936. Last year, Cadie, C-A-D-I, a soft-coated Wheaton Terrier, fetched $12,200. And there is a picture here of Nixon, the 2023 Little Yellow Dog. Cute little guy, and that's on that story. Our next story, School Board Approves New District Calendars, is written by Caitlin Yamada, and the dateline is Sioux City. The Sioux City Community School District calendars will now have 2-hour early outs on Fridays beginning next year. A public hearing was held for proposed calendars for the 2024-25, 2025-26, and 2026-27 school years on Monday. The board unanimously approved the new calendar. The biggest change is moving the weekly time for teacher professional development. Instead of a 1-hour early out on Mondays, the district is moving to 2-hour early outs on Fridays. Human Resources Director Jen Gomez said the change is based on feedback received from district staff, parents, and committees. Superintendent Rod Earlywine said he has heard from other school districts in the state who have been making the same switch. I've heard really good things from those school districts that the parents are fine with it and the staff really likes it, he said. He said of the more than 4,000 responses to a survey, 63% of the responses said they were in favor of Friday early outs. Another change to the calendar is the timing of school conferences. For years, the district has had parent-teacher conferences on Mondays and Tuesdays with no school on Mondays twice a year. The proposed calendar would switch the conference to Tuesdays and Thursdays with no school on Thursdays. Next story, LGBTQ students sue over new state law. Law restricts school books, students' preferred pronouns. Written by Aaron Murphy, Journal Des Moines Bureau. Dateline is Des Moines. 7 Iowa students are named as plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit filed Tuesday that challenges a new sweeping state law that places restrictions on LGBTQ students and school materials. The ACLU of Iowa joined two law firms in filing a lawsuit challenging Iowa's Senate File 496, which prohibits the instruction of gender identity and sexual orientation through sixth grade, prohibits books with descriptions of sex acts, and requires parental notification when a K-12 student wants to be referred to by a different pronoun on name or name in school. The law was passed by Republican state lawmakers and signed into law in May by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. The lawsuit asked the court for an immediate halt to enforcement of the law during the legal challenge. Attorneys said the lawsuit argues the state law violates the First Amendment right to free speech of Iowa's LGBTQ students, and asked the court to find the entire law unconstitutional. The students are identified in the lawsuit only by initials, but some choose to speak Tuesday at a news conference hosted by the ACLU of Iowa. Like it or not, sex and sexuality are parts of the teenage experience. Refusing to provide adolescents with information about it means they'll seek out their own information from the internet or from others in ways that are significantly less safe than books reviewed by teachers and librarians. Puck Carlson, a senior from Iowa City, who is one of the 7 student plaintiffs, said Tuesday in a statement read during an online news conference, "Removing books that discuss queer topics of people from schools tells our creative students that they do not belong there, that they are shameful. I am not shameful." The federal lawsuit was filed in the Southern District of Iowa. The ACLU of Iowa, Lambda Legal, and the law firm Jenner and Block are representing the 7 students at Iowa Safe Schools, a nonprofit that advocates for LGBTQ students in Iowa. "The state law is a clear violation of public school students' First Amendment rights to speak, read, and learn freely," ACLU of Iowa lawyer Thomas Story said during the news conference. He continued, "The First Amendment does not allow our state or our schools to remove books or issue blanket bans on discussion and material simply because a group of politicians or parents find them offensive," end quote. A similar law in Florida was unsuccessfully challenged in federal court there. Lawyers representing the plaintiffs in Iowa said they believe the outcome will be different here. They pointed to other cases in other states where courts did intervene. But the cases they noted involved higher education or public libraries, not K-12 schools. "We are committed to continuing to challenge any restrictions on student speech wherever they appear. These latest attacks are just another chapter," said Nathan Maxwell, a senior attorney with Lambda Legal, which is helping to represent the plaintiffs. We think that the Iowa law is so clearly unconstitutional as it's written and as it's applied, and we're very confident in our case. We expect the court will agree with us, he said. Iowa State Republican leaders issued statements Tuesday defending the new state law that they passed, with some of them arguing that pornography should not be in Iowa schools. The new law does not actually ban pornography. It bans books or curriculum that describe sexual acts. That has led some schools to remove from their libraries some books that contain depictions of sexual acts, including classics like To Kill a Mockingbird and 1984. Plus, books with LGBTQ themes or by LGBTQ authors that contain passages describing sexual acts. The law exempts religious texts, including the Bible. Protecting children from pornography and sexually explicit content shouldn't be controversial. The real controversy is that it exists in elementary schools, Reynolds said in a statement. Books with graphic depictions of sex acts have absolutely no place in our schools. If these books were movies, they'd be rated R, said Republican Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitaker in a statement. The state of Iowa has a legitimate interest in protecting elementary school children from being provided pornography in taxpayer-funded schools. Senate File 496 put parents first in the education of their children, and Senate Republicans will continue to advance policies to empower parents so Iowa students receive the best education in the country. That's Whitaker quote, end quote. Added Republican Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley in a statement. House Republicans stand behind the law that overwhelmingly passed our chamber. The sexualization of children in schools does not have a place in Iowa. This is a responsible and reasonable law that I believe all Iowans could get behind if the far left and the media would stop playing politics and accurately represent what is actually in the law. Reynolds joined Grassley in criticizing media outlets for their coverage of the topic. The new law went into effect this summer, and enforcement is scheduled to begin January 1. The Iowa Board of Education recently approved new state rules for implementation of the law. Education groups criticized the rules in the same way they did the law itself as being too vague. Now turning to the local section, here's a headline, Search Resumes for Missing Truck Driver. It's written by the Journal staff and the dateline is Sac City. Search operations resumed Wednesday morning for missing Walls Lake, Iowa truck driver David Schultz. The United Cajun Navy, a nonprofit outfit that organizes search and rescue teams, said in a Facebook post Tuesday night that the search would resume at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday. The group has moved its command post to the Sac City Motel, 103 Ash Avenue, Sac City. The group planned to scour land outside Sac City, heading east toward Highway 4, and according to the Facebook post, a number of the area property owners have granted permission for their properties to be searched. Schultz, a 53-year-old married father of 10-year-old twin boys, vanished more than a week ago. He was last heard from in the early morning hours, November 21, according to the Lakeview Police Department. His truck was found that afternoon northeast of Sac City, parked on northbound U.S. Highway 71, about 5 miles north of the old U.S. Highway 20 intersection. The truck was reportedly turned off, but it wasn't pulled over, and the trailer was still loaded with young pigs. Over the past weekend, volunteers searched for Schultz in Wright, Webster, Calhoun, and Sac counties. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation is involved in the case, along with the Sac County Sheriff's Office and the Lakeview Police Department. Schultz's disappearance has garnered a significant amount of interest online and social media. On Tuesday, the Woodbury County Sheriff's Office took to Facebook to say there was no evidence or indication that a Monday traffic stop involving a reckless driver near Moville had any connection to the case. The driver in the case was arrested for possession of cocaine and felon in possession of a firearm. Here's a brief or two. Reward offered for information on Sheldon arson fire, and the dateline is Sheldon. Reward is being offered to anyone who can provide information about an arson incident at a Sheldon house. Fire damaged the vacant home at 1302 South 5th Avenue on November 15. There was no active electric service at the house. And the Sheldon Police Department continues to investigate the fire and is asking anyone with information about the incident to contact police. The O'Brien County Crime Dusters Program is offering a $500 reward to anyone who provides information that leads to an arrest and conviction in the case. Anyone with information can call the Sheldon Police Department at 712-324-2525 or the O'Brien County Sheriff's Office at 712-957-3415. Tips also may be submitted online at the sheriff's website at obrioncounty-sheriff.com. Information may be provided anonymously. And Sioux City Police investigating a store robbery. Sioux City Police are looking for information on a robbery that took place at a Morningside convenience store Wednesday morning. Shortly after 6:45 a.m., a man entered Sarge's Mini Mart, 3407 Glen Avenue, handed the clerk a note demanding cash from the register. The suspect, described as a short Hispanic male, wearing black coat with red hood and red face mask, grabbed two cartons of cigarettes when other customers walked in. He didn't get any money from the register. The suspect then left on foot northwest of the store. This investigation is ongoing, police said. Anyone with additional information is asked to call the Sioux City Police Department at 712-279-6440 or Crime Stoppers at 712-258-8477. Another short story. Dorothy Picaut, P-E-C-A-U-T, Nature Center to host free winter fun day. The Nature Center at 4500 Sioux River Road will be hosting a winter fun day with a variety of indoor and outdoor activities from 10 p.m. to 2 p.m. on December 9. Guided hikes complete with marshmallow roast and a Nerf gun target range will take place at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. Indoor activities will include meeting live animals, craft stations, as well as vendors' booths for holiday shopping. Now, this free event is open to the public and is designed for all ages. More information about Nature Center activities and events is available by calling 712-258-0838. Going back here to read a story, The Pope Punishes Conservative U.S. Critic. It's written by Nicole Winfield of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Vatican City. Pope Francis has decided to punish one of his highest-ranking critics, Cardinal Raymond Burke, by revoking his right to a subsidized Vatican apartment and salary in the second such radical action against a conservative American prelate this month, according to two people briefed on the measures. Francis told a meeting of the heads of Vatican offices last week that he was moving against Burke because he was a source of disunity in the church, said one of the participants at the November 20 meeting. The participant spoke on condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to reveal the contents of the encounter. Francis said he was removing Burke's privileges of having a subsidized Vatican apartment and salary as a retired cardinal because he was using the privileges against the church, said another person who was subsequently briefed on the Pope's measures. That person also spoke on condition of anonymity because he wasn't authorized to reveal the details. Burke has not received any notification of measures being taken, his secretary said in a text message Tuesday to the Associated Press. Burke, a 75-year-old canon lawyer, whom Francis had fired as the Vatican's High Court Justice in 2014, has become one of the most outspoken critics of the Pope. His outreach to LGBTQ+ Catholics and his reform project to make the church more responsive to the needs of ordinary faithful. Twice, Burke has joined other conservative cardinals in issuing formal questions to the pontiff, known as dubia, asking him to clarify questions of doctrine that upset conservatives and traditionalists. In the first, They asked Francis to clarify his outreach to divorced and civilly remarried Catholics, and Francis never replied. In the second, they asked whether same-sex couples could receive church blessings and received a conditional maybe in response. And then, on the eve of Francis's big meeting of bishops last month, known as a synod, Burke presided over a counter-synod of sorts just steps away from St. Peter's Square. And there, Burke delivered a stinging rebuke of France's vision of synodality, as well as his overall reform project for the church. It's unfortunately very clear that the invocation of the Holy Spirit by some has the aim of bringing forward an agenda that is more political and human than ecclesial and divine, Burke told the conference titled The Synodal Babel, S-Y-N-O-D-A-L. Burke has always defended his actions as being of service to the church and the papacy, saying it was his obligation as a cardinal and bishop to uphold church teaching and correct errors. The sheep depend on the courage of pastors who must protect them from the poison of confusion, error, and division, he told the October 3 conference, prompting applause from the crowd. Burke, who spends much of his time in the U.S. at the Our Lady of Guadalupe Shrine he founded in his native Wisconsin, is the second American prelate to face punishment in what appears to be a new phase of Francis's pontificate. This reform-minded period seems to have accelerated with the arrival in September of Francis's handpicked new doctrine czar, Cardinal Victor Fernandez. Okay, folks, I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I'm going to go back to a couple short stories. Brief from the Sioux City Journal. Pierce Mansion hosting free holiday open house. It's free refreshments, festive entertainment, and a visit for Santa Claus are among the highlights during the Sioux City Museum and Historical Association's holiday open house from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday at the John Pierce Mansion at 2901 Jackson Street. This event will also feature a musical performance by harpist Mary Watts. The historic Victoria-era mansion will be open to the public as a way of saying thank you to the community for its support throughout the year. Volunteers on the Pierce Mansion Committee have restored the mansion back to its former glory after the Sioux City Public Museum and moved downtown 12 years ago. More recently, the Pierce Mansion was featured on the 2023 Big Brothers Big Sisters Tour of Homes. Built in 1893 by local developer John Pierce, the home was purchased by the Junior League of Sioux City for $10,000 in 1958. It served as the site of the Sioux City Public Museum from 61 to 2011. The mansion is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. For more information on Sioux City Public Museum events and activities, you may call 712-279-6174 or visit siouxcitymuseum.org. And two bird flu cases confirmed in Woodbury County is a small headline here. Sioux City, the Dateline. Highly pathogenic avian influenza, commonly referred to as bird flu, has been confirmed at two sites in Woodbury County. Both affected the sites are backyard mixed species flocks, according to a news release from the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. The highly contagious disease has reappeared in Iowa this fall after sweeping across the state in the spring of 2022 and again in the fall and winter. Since October 20, bird flu has been confirmed in commercial facilities in Buena Vista and Sioux counties, game bird ducks in Clay County, and numerous flocks in other Iowa counties. Commercial and backyard flock owners are encouraged to prevent contact between their birds and wild birds. Sick birds or unusual deaths should be immediately reported to state or federal officials. Owners who suspect bird flu in their flocks are advised to contact their veterinarian immediately. Possible cases must be reported to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship at 515-281-5305. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said the recent bird flu cases do not present a public health concern and it remains safe to eat poultry products. Bird flu is a viral disease affecting bird populations. It can travel in wild birds without those birds appearing sick, but is often fatal to domestic birds such as chickens and turkeys. And here's a correction. Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor beat incumbent Marty Pottenbaum by around 1,800 votes in the 2020 general election. An A1 story in the Journal Saturday titled "Taylor Urged to Step Down" incorrectly identified the difference in vote counts between the two candidates. And here's a story from page 4 of the Local and State, and is written by Jared McNett, Sioux City, The Dateline. J.D. Scholten announces re-election bid for Iowa House District 1 seat, is the headline. J.D. Scholten, the first-term representative for Iowa House District 1, announced Wednesday morning he's running for re-election. Scholten, the only Democratic Party state legislator in Northwest Iowa, said a motivator for his campaign for a second term is to get the Iowa legislature back to focusing on people, not politics. He went on, "I love Sioux City. It's been an honor to represent this town area down at the Capitol. When you love where you're from, you fight for the people who make your community work," said Scholten, whose district includes a sizable chunk of Sioux City. "There's no doubt that this past session, the majority party lost track of the Iowa values we all hold on to and want to improve by them passing school vouchers, one of the most extreme abortion bans in the country, kicking thousands of Iowans, including children, off of medical and food benefits, rolling back our child labor laws and more," end quote. Mr. Scholten's quote. During the 2023 session, Scholten, who ran unopposed in 2022, voted against the gender-affirming health care ban for minors, restrictions on LGBTQ topics in school library books, a loosening of child labor laws, and the creation of education savings accounts. All of those bills became law. He did not vote on the abortion restrictions bill, but has said he would have been a strong no. All of these controversial bills that made headlines all had two things in common. They were only passed by Republicans while having bipartisan opposition, and these bills were part of a national special interest agenda that didn't come from Iowa voters, Scholten said. And prior to his win in 2022, Scholten unsuccessfully ran to represent Iowa's 4th Congressional District. He lost to former Representative Steve King, Republican of Chiron, in 2018, and Representative Randy Feenstra, Republican of Hull, in 2020. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll return to today's obituaries. Quite a few obituaries on the paper today. Here's Beverly Jean Witzel. Beverly Jean Witzel, 83, of Prescott, passed away Thursday the 23rd. Her daughter's home in Prescott, Arizona, surrounded by love. A celebration of life will be held at 12 p.m. December 7th, 2023, at her daughter Candace Lee's home. For more information, contact candalee2016@gmail.com. That is candacelea2016@gmail.com. Beverly was born on September 12, 1940, in Sioux City, daughter of Florence Wyant Peterson and Vern Moulton. Beverly lived most of her life in the Sioux City area until lightning hit her apartment building in North Sioux City in South Dakota in 2020. This forced Beverly to move to Arizona to be closer to her family. She loved cooking, shopping, dancing, playing cribbage, and watching Judge Judy and Family Feud. Beverly's greatest love was spending quality time with her family. And survivors include her daughter, Sandy, spouse Craig Molstad of Chandler, Arizona, son Randy, spouse Julie Cormany of Apache Junction, Arizona, daughter Candace Lee, spouse Tim of Prescott, and son Raleigh, spouse Chris Witzel of Sioux City, daughter Christy Froelich of Prescott, 11 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. Mom will be remembered for her love of her family, her kind spirit, her strength and perseverance, and her love to have fun. That's a quote. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Willard Whitzel, her sister Corrine Clay, and brother Vern Moulton. Edward George Kunze of rural Winnebago, Nebraska, passed away November 24, 2023, after a brief illness. Ed, also known as Bube, B-U-E-B, was 86 years old. Celebration of Life will be held at a later date to be announced. He was the youngest child of Ed and Emma Zwigart Gunzi. Born July 22, 1937, he graduated from Winnebago High School in 1957, was proud of his 1957 Chevy and that he saw Elvis Presley in Sioux City in that era. Ed was a charmer, known for his lack of filter and penchant for political incorrectness. He was a successful farmer, a notorious tinkerer, a fixer, and a devil not a man. He was a diddly dip of a noisemaker and passed that trait on to his boisterous children. Ed was preceded in death by his parents, three brothers, Harold, Kenny, and Donnie, his grandson, Jacob Donald, and the mother of his children, Peg Kunze. He is survived by his five children, Don, Carolyn, Dan, Mary, and Beth, as well as seven grandchildren and four great-grandchildren, and with a little editing, he was the perfect father. Donna Jean Goberson, Cherokee, 91, passed away on November 28th, funeral services at 10:30 a.m. on December 1 at Trinity Lutheran Church. Burial will be in the St. John's Lutheran Cemetery at Galva. Visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. on November 30th, with the family present from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Boothby Funeral Home. Sabra L. Jackson, that's spelled S-A-B-R-A, 71 of Sioux City, passed away on Saturday, the 25th of November, at a local care facility. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, December 1st, at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Sioux City. Reverend Kevin Fries will officiate. Burial will be at 1 p.m. on Monday, December 4, at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on Thursday. That would be tonight, with a prayer service at 6:30 at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Casual dress for Sabra's services is encouraged by her family. S-A-B-R-A, Sabra, I hope is that the way it's pronounced. Online and condolences may be directed to meyerbroschapels.com. She was born in September 26th in Mitchell, South Dakota, graduated from Sergeant Bluff High School on December 12, 1981. She married James J.J. Jackson in McCook Lake, South Dakota. She raised her children as a homemaker during her younger years, also worked for the Sioux City Community School District and at St. Luke's, and finished her working career in the jewelry department at Sears. She was a member of Westminster Presbyterian Church in Sioux City. In her free time, Sabra enjoyed fishing, playing bingo, and swimming at the YMCA. She loved traveling, including her yearly trips to Okoboji, which she would spend weeks planning and preparing for, and trips to Las Vegas. She loved Saturday night dinners with J.J. and their daughter, Shaylee and Rob Rose. Sabra was an animal lover, especially her two dogs. Survivors include her husband, J.J., children Jenny, Jess, and Shaylee, siblings Chuck Nash, spouse Julie, and Sandy Carroll, and many nieces, nephews, cousins, and close friends who were like family. She was preceded in death by her parents, Bob and Loretta Gamblin Nash, brothers Dennis Nash, Robert Nash, and Joe Daldorf, and a granddaughter, Taylin. Sabra's family would like to thank Hospice of Siouxland and Palliative Care Team at St. Luke's and the staff at Junie Nyland Center for all their hard work and loving care. Going to continue now and maybe cut these a little bit short. We have a lot of them here, so try to read a good share of it. Stephen Steve, Miss Mount M. Harris, 81, died Monday the 27th, local hospital in Sioux City. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday the 30th, Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Morningside Chapel, 1801 Morningside Avenue, with a prayer service at 6:30 p.m. Mass of Christian Burial will be 10 a.m. Friday, December 1, at the Mater Dei Parish Church of the Nativity, and burial will be 1 p.m. Monday, December 4, at the Memorial Park Cemetery. Steve and Steve Morris Harris, the son of Morris and Anna Bilunas Harris, born April 24, 1942, in Sioux City, graduated from East High School in 1960. He was an apprentice of Callens Indoor Comfort and then went to work for them. Here is Kathy Stamer, S-T-A-H-M-E-R, formerly of Salix, Iowa. After 6 years of appendix cancer, I decided to let chemo, radiation, and surgeries all go. Of course, letting go of my two beautiful children, my loving family, and my wonderful friends was not as easy. I will miss you. You made my life so good. Kathy Marie Stamer, S-T-A-H-M-E-R, Reich, died on November 22, 2023. Time for family and friends to gather will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, December 3, at the Oxford American Legion, 128 East Main Street in Oxford, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Iowa City Hospice. She was born October 17, 1952, to Jim and Leela Simpson Reich in Salix, Iowa. After graduating from Westwood Community Schools in 1970 and the University of Southern Dakota in 1974, she began teaching 7th grade math at Tipton's Community School. She loved Tipton and her students. Now, she married Melvin Mel Stamer on April 25th, 1987. They had two children, Carly and John. When the children were ready to start school, Kathy worked part-time in the area, first at Police Law Institute and then at Russell J. Meade CPA. When the kids were small, nothing was better than playing games and reading to them. Throughout life, she loved cooking, baking, reading, and her flower garden. Karen S. Scott of Holstein, Iowa, 65 years old, passed away November 21. Funeral service held that will be held 11 a.m. December 2 at St. Paul Evangelical Lutheran Church. Reverend Scott Newman officiating, burial at Oak Hill Cemetery of Cherokee, visitation 5 to 7 p.m. December 1 at the Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home in Holstein. And Marvin A. Doc Norby, 98 years old, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, November 25. Funeral services will be 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, December 5, at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service at the time at the funeral home. Brenda Sue Taylor, 56, of Sioux City, passed away unexpectedly, November 9. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, December 4, at Abundant Life Church, 809 South Alice Avenue, or South Alice, Sioux City, Iowa, Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Forrest Tim Schoenman, S-C-H-O-E-N-E-M-A-N, Jr. Forrest William Tim Schoenman, Jr., of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, November 18. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, December 4, at St. Thomas Episcopal Church, with a burial at Logan Park Cemetery, arrangements by Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Donald J. Don Sturdivant, 82, Sioux City, passed away unexpectedly on Saturday, November 25, in Madison, Wisconsin. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, the 2nd of December. Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Father Mark Stoll will be officiating. Visitation will be from 4:30 to 8 p.m. Friday, with a vigil service at 6:30 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Online condolences may be directed to MeyerBroschapels.com, MeyerBroschapels.com. And Norma Agnes McCarthy, 85, of Sioux City, passed away November 25 at Methodist Hospital in Omaha. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 1, at Meyer Brothers Funeral Homes, 3220 Stone Park Boulevard in Sioux City. A mass will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, December 2, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, 5010 Military Road, Sioux City. Burial will follow mass in McCook Cemetery, McCook County, McCook, South Dakota. And Norma was preceded in death by her husband, Paul McCarthy, parents, sisters, Doris Rolfs and Dorothy Hurley, and brother Francis Rolfs. Alicia Cohen of Sioux City, 56 years old, passed away on Sunday, November 26. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, December 2, at St. Boniface Catholic Church. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is assisting with arrangements. Online condolences may be directed to the www.meyerbrothers.com. Dora was born in 1967 in El Salvador. And we're going to Patricia Probasco, 91, of Sioux City, passed away on Wednesday, November 22. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, December 1. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel in Sioux City with Reverend Roger Madden officiating. No visitation is planned. Burial will be at Logan Park Cemetery following the burial. There will be a luncheon at the Sioux City Country Club. Patricia Pat, the daughter of Ralph and Mabel Ierley, shoemaker, was born August 4, 1932 in Winterset, Iowa. Pat grew up and attended school in Winterset, and during her senior year, she met her husband, her future husband, Jean A. Probasco, at a dance in her hometown. After graduating from Winterset High, she attended Drake University in Des Moines. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to any veterans organization of choice. Pat's family would like to thank her caregivers at Holy Spirit for their wonderful and loving care. And here's the final one for today. James R. Davis, 92, of Cherokee, passed away Monday, November 20, at the care facility in Cherokee. Services will be held 12 p.m. Sunday, December 3, at the Community of Christ, 3232 Transit Avenue. Arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service, Sioux City. So now it's time to turn to the sports section of the paper. And we've got the Sioux City Journal, November 30. There's a front page here. NAIA Volleyball Tournament, Northwestern 3, St. Ambrose 1. Raiders prevail in pool opener. And there's a picture, a nice color picture, Northwestern's Emma Westfall, number 15, hits past St. Ambrose Alex Horn during the NAIA Women's Volleyball Championship. Top-seeded Northwestern beat Ambrose in four sets as pool play began Wednesday at the Tyson Events Center. And so it is written by Ryan Timmerman. Dateline is Sioux City. Even with the opponent set on taking away the top weapon for the Northwestern College volleyball team, the Red Riders found a way. Northwestern, the number one overall seed in the NAIA A national tournament, beat number 24 St. Ambrose in four sets, 25-15, 25-22, 24-26, 25-19, in the opening game of pool play on Wednesday at the Tyson Events Center. We hadn't played in 10 days, so there was almost some first-game jitters again, Northwestern head coach Kyle Van Den Bosch said. St. Ambrose head coach Don Steinhauser focused her attention, rather her squad, on defending Northwestern junior outside hitter Jaslyn DeHaan, reigning Great Plains Athletic Conference's Player of the Year. Our game plan worked initially and worked very, really well, Steinhauser said. We knew we had to contain DeHaan, so I put my biggest blocker in the gym on her and tried to shut her down. But Northwestern is a great team and had other kids set up, step up. For us to battle with them, we had to make them beat us somewhere else because they're used to DeHaan being able to control the match. Kudos to them. They were able to do that. DeHaan still managed a dozen kills but was well below her season efficiency entering Wednesday, .256, as it took her 46 attempts to get to 12 kills against Bees. But with the defense's attention on DeHaan, Northwestern depth helped the Red Raiders prevail. Two other Red Raiders reached double figures in kills. Junior outside Allison Dexter went for 16 kills on 40 attempts, and junior right side Savon Sturck enjoyed an efficient outing with 10 kills on 23 attempts for a .348 swing percentage. I think a big thing for us was to play fearless, Dexter said. All of these games are going to be against great competition. It's going to be a fight, but we needed to get out of our own heads and have fun. Everyone's been doing their parts. We're playing gritty and laying it all on the court. Freshman setter Logan Miller, a Dakota Valley alum, went for 22 assists, 5 digs, and 2 aces for the Red Raiders. Miller also had one kill, which came at an opportune time as it forced a St. Ambrose timeout, with the Bees clinging to a 21-20 lead in set 3 after Northwestern scored 3 straight. Sophomore setter Liv Reitzma added 22 assists. It's been a big honor for me to be part of this team, Miller said. I'm playing with a lot of talented girls that are making me better every single day. I'm so grateful and blessed to be around such a great team and the coaches we have. A DeHaan kill tied it at 21, but the Bees would go on to score the final 3 points of the third set to force a fourth. That came after Miller's second ace tied the third set at time. After losing the third set, we just needed to clean up things on our side of the net, Miller said, finding where they were on defense and getting back to clicking as a team. Despite being down, we were really resilient as a team. Everyone's attitude stayed up going into the fourth set, even though St. Ambrose was a really good team. While the second set was tight as well and went in favor of Northwestern, the Red Raiders got off to hot starts in the first and last sets, which paved the way for the win. In set 1, Northwestern 28-2 shot out of the gate to the tune of a 5-1 lead, and the Red Raiders scored the first 4 points of set 4. Those leads were awesome, Dexter said. St. Ambrose 20-15 managed to tie it at 12 in the fourth, but never led in the final set. Senior outside Meredith Siebers finished with a match-high 19 kills for the Bees on 46 attempts, and junior middle hitter Meredith Umland chipped in 13 kills. Graduate senior Hannah Sundag led the match in assists with 41 and finished with a team-high 16 digs. Northwestern junior libero Olivia Granstra led the match in digs 22, aces 3, as the Red Raiders doubled up the Bees in scoring services 8-4. Both teams have a match in pool play yet to come, as each will play Bellevue, Nebraska. St. Ambrose takes on the Bruins at 10 a.m. on Thursday, while the Red Raiders get their shot at the number 16 seed on Friday, 10 a.m., with Northwestern now in the driver's seat to advance to the bracket tournament comprised on the winners each of the 8 3-team pools. I thought our girls came out strong and really played well, Van Den Bosch. I thought we were smart with our attack, and our back row did a really good job. Going into the fourth, we could see it in their eyes. They didn't like how that third set went. I thought we had a chance to take the third set. We almost came back and got it. Still doing some sports here. Here's an idea of what you can find on the television and listen to. College basketball men's at 5:30 p.m., FS1, Texas Tech is at Butler. That's today, Thursday. BTN, New Orleans is at Minnesota. College basketball, 8 p.m. ESPN2, Creighton at Oklahoma State. Pac-12N, Hawaii versus Utah, Salt Lake City. College basketball for women, 4 p.m. ACCN. ACC-SEC Challenge, Missouri is at Virginia, SECN. Is Duke at Virginia, and 6 p.m. on ACCN is the Alabama at Syracuse, CBSSN, Michigan State's at DePaul, ESPN has South Carolina at North Carolina, ESPN2 has Arkansas at Florida State, and SECN has Boston College at Kentucky at 7 p.m., ESPNU has Baylor at SMU. And go to, there's some golf on here too, but I'm going to go over here to NFL football. At 7:15, you have the prime video. Seattle is at Dallas. On soccer, men's soccer, FS2, Saudi Pro League, Al-Ahli at Abha. Tennis, 6 a.m. tennis. ATP Next Generation Finals Round Robin. Let's move on to college basketball. Men's at 5:30 p.m. FS1. Houston's at Xavier. ESPN2. St. John's at West Virginia. And we've got 7:30 p.m. FS1. Iowa State at DePaul. 8 p.m. ESPN number 2. UConn at Kansas. And college football, 7 p.m. ABC Pac-12 Championship. Oregon at Washington. Las Vegas. Here's a couple notes from the sports section this week in history. November 28, 1981, Alabama's Paul Bear Bryant becomes the winningest coach in college football history when the Crimson Tide beats Auburn 28-17 in the Iron Bowl. It's Bryant's 315th career victory, surpassing Amos Alonzo Stagg for most wins. And Bobby Bowden becomes the first major college coach to win 10 games in 6 straight seasons as Florida State beats Florida 45-24 to finish the regular season at 10-1. November 28, 1992 is when that happened. And in 2015, November 28, Paxton Lynch ties the FBS record with 7 touchdown passes in a half, and Memphis set single-season records for yards and points in a 63-0 win over SMU. And November 29 of 1890, Navy beats Army 24-0 in the first matchup of this historic series. November 29, 2003, Maryland's Bruce Perry rushes for 237 yards, while Wake Forest's Chris Barkley gains 243 yards, marking the first time in ACC history and only the 5th time in NCAA history that opposing backs have more than 200 rushing yards in the same game. Perry scores 3 touchdowns in the Terrapins' 41-28 win. Before we wrap it up today, on the online poll, yesterday's poll question, have you ever seen a production of The Nutcracker, is the question. The answer on the poll was 47% had yes, and 53% said no. And speak out. Today's question, what pet do you have the fondest memories of? You can sound off at www.facebook.com/Sioux City Journal. And there's a quote on here before we close it off. It says, never believe that a few caring people can't change the world, for indeed that's all who ever have. That's a Margaret Mead quote, 1901-1978, American scientist. So that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. I want to thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, one in four people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home, so take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors, and install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.